It's about that time of year again. No, I'm not talking about the holiday season. That's for drunks and pedos. I'm talking about the lead up to the second annual Bloody Awards, in which Murder Was the Case patrons cast their votes for their favorite moments and episodes of 2019 in one of 8 different categories on patreon.com/murderwasthecase. The 2019 Bloody Awards are sponsored by Datsu Sara, Hemp Gear for Victory at dsgear.com, and the Crawlspace Media Network. Last year, Sergeant Barry Rules, Unmasking the Beast, swept the Bloodies with wins in Best Fight Story, Most Heroic Guest, and Best Dive Bar categories. But as so many of the episodes this year were outstanding, it's going to be a much tighter race, I think. In fact, it was so competitive that the rigors of selecting the nominees actually drove me to drink. Okay, yeah, quite a lot drives me to drink, but at least I don't drink and drive, man. At least I don't drink and drive, man. Unfortunately, despite my best laid plans, I didn't get around to creating enough Academy episodes this year to make it a viable category, so the winner by default is Everything You Know About Serial Killers Is Wrong. One of the reasons I didn't have time to make enough Academy episodes, though, was because of those 6 trailblazing murder lectures I gave in VR. If you didn't see those on YouTube, the links are in this episode's description, so you'll be voting on your favorite VR lecture instead, if you're a patron. Come to think of it, those are really just academies with visuals. This year, I'm also adding a most heartbreaking moment category to create the illusion that Murder Was the Case is in touch with its non-existent feelings. So you'll be voting for funniest moment, most chilling moment, best fight story, most heartbreaking moment, most heroic guest, most grizzled moment, best VR lecture, and best dive bar. Now, without further ado, the nominees for funniest moment are Marty Kerluck for Gun Schooled.
This recent rise in gun-related crimes in Toronto is mostly through guns obtained illegally, so to change the law, just to reiterate, is not going to have an effect on that.
You can't make guns more illegaler, you know, and I use that term, and nobody laughed in the Senate. I was kind of hoping I'd get a few chuckles there, but that's the term I use. You can't make them more illegaler. They're already illegal.
Detective Cloyd Steiger for Confessions of a Seattle Homicide Detective.
So at one point he's talking about one of his cases, and he says to me, he's Filipino, he goes, "The little girl walked up to me and she said, 'Uncle Frank, I'm horny. I want to suck your penis.' I said, 'No, little girl, I would be in trouble with Aunt Vicky,'" which is his wife. And she said, "No, I just want to." And I said, "Maybe just for a second." And I said, "Did she suck your penis, Frank?" "Just for a second." It was longer than a second, wasn't it, Frank? "Well, a couple seconds." "Did you ejaculate in her mouth?" "Yeah." "How old was she, Frank?" "She was 4. I mean, that's exactly what he said. That's like that. So he 4. Confesses to all. Yeah, this guy is a bad actor. My favorite time for that night, though, is we're walking. By this time, it's like 11:30 at night. I've had this case since 8 in the morning. It's 11:30 at night. We're walking out to the police garage, put him in a case car to take him to the jail across the street to get book him in jail. And he looks at me and goes, "Detective Steiger, I know you don't like me. You think I'm a bad man." And I said, "Frank, I don't think any less of you now than I did when I met you." And he goes, "Oh, thanks."
Dr. John Faithful Hamer for Charge the Shooter.
It's like kids when they look at the one kid who's like 7 years old and he still shits his pants in the playground. Like, no kid looks at that kid and says, "I've never shit my pants." Because you remember when you shit your pants. Yeah. But you're potty trained now. Right? And you look at that kid and you're like, wow, he should be potty trained by now. When I look at a serial killer or somebody who does horrible things, I don't think you are not one of me. I just think, why are you not potty trained in terms of your ability to control your sexual and violent impulses? Mm-hmm. Like, why are you shitting your pants at the age of 35? Like, shouldn't, you know what I mean? Like, that's what I think.
Dr. Chris Kunkel for Dirty Dark Minds.
Were you there yesterday when I was talking about the tractor fetish?
Yeah.
And the guy who was engaging in autoerotic asphyxiation with his tractor and fell in love with the tractor and wrote cards to it. And
you were telling it specifically to me, and I think you said that's at the point where you stopped trying to really figure out this, like you realized that there was a limit to it, like you kind of rubbed your hands and
it can go anywhere.
Gary Lowe, he won't mind me telling this story, but he had a case where a guy was having sex with a dead deer by the side of the road, which that's necrozoophilia, but even more complex, he had put pantyhose on the deer, right? I mean, that's what you said with the tractor. Like, that's the same thing with that, too. It's like, at that point, you're
kind of... Now he's personifying the deer and sexualizing it and adding a nylon fetish, and it's dead.
Yeah, it's almost like he's creating like a chimera, you know, like it's half human because it's got human pantyhose on. But
well, and so and then in treatment, the question would become, well... Did you pick the dead deer because it was dead, or was that the only deer you could get pantyhose on? Yeah. Was it more about putting the pantyhose on the deer, or was it more about having a dead deer or a dead animal?
What's the primary?
Right, and he may not have any idea whatsoever.
Well, those are all pretty chuckle-upable, but undoubtedly, one will have tickled you more than the others. So go to patreon.com/murderwasthecase and weigh in. The second category is most chilling story. And as in the previous year, some of these accounts were actually experienced firsthand by our guests, which makes them extra creepy. Still, Robert Hachowski won in 2018 for his eerie secondhand account of an abduction. So don't underestimate the power of good storytelling. Here are the nominees. Robert Baltovich for The Baltovich File.
So we walk back up to the campus, and we were just standing right by her car. And it was a very strange night because, of course, on the way up, she thought she had heard a noise in the woods. And she stopped, and she was terrified. And I'd never seen her react that way before. And I thought, oh, this is kind of weird, like, because normally she's not like that. But when we got back up to the top of the path, and when we were just sitting by our respective cars, you know, getting ready to say our goodbyes, she looked at me and she said, you know, I don't mean to make it seem like you're a ninny, but if there had been someone there, we wouldn't have stood a chance. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting thing to say. Like, it was just the whole vibe was very strange. But in any event, we grabbed each other and, like, we were holding each other, and she looked at me, and that was the last time I saw her.
Karen Wickham for Kermit's House of Horrors.
When they went to his home was absolutely filthy. The front lawn was just disgusting. It had garbage, like, bags of garbage piled up. He also was a hoarder. They had like 6 televisions and so many DVD players and stereo equipment, unwrapped clothes, like expensive clothing, not taken out of boxes. So he would just spend and hoard it and never use it. His wife did it. His kids did it. So when they walk in, he goes and sits at his piano and starts playing Chopin.
What a psycho.
So he was playing music and he's like, da 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 da. He's like, this one, I could have had my grade 10, and he's playing the piano. So can you imagine being raiding his place, and this psycho is sitting at a piano, serenading them or whatever, with classical music? They're like, we're going down to the basement to check, because they wanted to see if he had boxes of charts, because he started removing charts from his clinic. He goes, I wouldn't go down there. And he's playing the piano, and they're like, why? He goes, because I have fleas. And they're like, well, how bad can it be? So they put on hazmat suits, got down about 4 steps, and hear crinkle, 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 crackle. They turn the light on. They've already, like, 4 steps down, they have fleas up to their knees. Black. The noises they heard was that there was, like, a foot deep of a flea infestation in the basement. And they just got the fuck out of there. And he goes, see, I can't be such a bad guy. I warned you about the fleas. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do on his piano.
Susanna Ryan for In Code Blood.
it was Valentine's Day, and they went to pick her up or check on her, and she didn't come to the door, which they thought was odd, and I guess they had a key, and they went in, and they're calling for her. Her name was Jody and Sarin, and the dad eventually walked into her bedroom, and she's in the bedroom, but she's with a guy, and he's like, oh, okay, caught him in a compromising situation. So, you know, he's kind of embarrassed. He's like, oh, okay, just get dressed and come out. The mom is there too. They're waiting in the living room. They're waiting. They're like, what is going on? He goes back in to check on her. She's in the bedroom. The guy is gone, and she's dead. And she has been for about 12 hours.
Detective Cloyd Steiger for Confessions of a Seattle Homicide Detective.
When he started to tie her up, he said he raped her, and he was going to get ready to kill her. And she said, you don't have to do this. I got babies at home. And he said, you tell it to Jesus when you see him in a minute. And he said, then I choked her ass out till her eyes bulged and she pissed herself and I knew she was dead.
Now, for whatever reason, there was a dearth of fight stories this year. But fortunately, Detective Cloyd Steiger came to the rescue with some epic tales of ass kicking and is therefore nominated twice for stories he told in Confessions of a Seattle Homicide Detective in Part 2.
My whole world went into slow motion. I remember stopping my car in the middle of the street, putting it in park, and I can hear the police radio saying, officers, use extreme caution. The suspect is armed and dangerous. Use extreme caution. I can just hear that. But as I'm getting out, again, everything's in slow motion. And I get my gun out. I'm standing there, and I do what's called a pancake move, where you just start edging sideways a little bit. As I get to where I can see behind the bush, there's a fence there and he's trapped. And the guy's standing there and he's got a gun in his hand and he's holding it down. And I got my gun and I'm saying, drop the fucking gun. And he's thinking about it, right? First of all, if I had an older officer, I'd have popped him right then.
Yeah.
Because he can pull that gun up and shoot me before I can react. But I had less than a year on the police department. Finally, he drops the gun and I run up and I grab him. I throw him down to the ground. And then I'm aware of somebody else that's there. And it's a guy I went to the academy with who saw my car down the street and came to me. And we get this guy handcuffed, you know. And then, of course, once he's handcuffed, the gun's there. And I'm like deep breathing. I'm hyperventilating. Somebody else comes. They take him to the station. Later on, I go into the station. And this guy's in a holding cell. He was a white guy, about 35. Richard Sanford DeShields was his name. And I said, do you know how close I came to killing you? And he looked at me and said, maybe that's what I wanted you to do.
And Part 3.
And I remember going into the jail and I'd show him the warrant. I said, here's the deal. We have a warrant to take your DNA. And he was like challenging me. You're not going to take my DNA. We're not going to take your blood. No, no, no. And you know, I'd say, no, listen, this is a warrant. We can take it. And we can take it by force if we need to. And then he's still challenging me. And I said, listen, you can either sit here and have this nice lady take your blood easily, or we'll just wipe it up off the floor when we're done.
Oh, Cloyd.
Yeah, that's what I said to him. And he stood up and tried to walk past me. I grabbed him by the throat and slammed him up against the wall. And he said, okay, and he take the blood.
Another nominee is Robert Baltovich for The Baltovich File.
We were lining up for refreshments. You know, every night around 9 o'clock, they bring out a jug of juice and a tray of cookies. And so I wasn't going to ruffle any feathers. So I made sure I was the last person in line. And when I got up to get my cookie, there were no cookies left. And I'm like, what's going on? Like, I don't get a cookie. And the guy says, well, sorry. He said, somebody must have stolen your cookie. Right. So some other guys heard that, right? And I guess I was a little worried because, like, I didn't want them to think I was a pushover. So I start looking around and I see a guy who's got two cookies, right? And I'm thinking, what do I do? Well, I mean, I can't let these guys think that I'm a pussy, right? Mm-hmm. I gotta fight for my cookie. I don't know what I was thinking. I must have been out of my mind, but I guess I was just, like, not in a good mood. And so I went up to him and I said, hey, man, I think that's my cookie. Right. And he's like, fuck off, man. This is my cookie. Fuck off. Right. And I'm like, no, I want my cookie. I want that cookie now. Right. And he's looking me over. Right. And he's like, is this guy crazy? Right. So anyway, he just hands me a cookie. Right. And he goes, here is your cookie. So I was quite proud of myself.
Yeah.
You know, and then I get into the cell and I said to my cellmate, I said, can you believe that guy? Like, thinking he could get away with stealing my cookie. And he looks at me. He goes, that guy didn't steal your cookie. He won that in a card game. He goes, somebody else stole your cookie.
And finally, Douglas McGregor for The Landscape of Crime.
So cheers to that, to your MMA.
My short MMA
career,
yeah.
Which was much longer than everyone who talks and only talks. So, to that.
It was fun. Stressed out the wife, but it was fun.
Just out of curiosity, those last two that moved your record in the other direction, what happened?
I lost the first two fights. They were out of my weight class. I fought up 20 pounds both times.
Wow. So what is your natural weight class?
165, 170.
So welterweight, like you're used UFC.
I'm comfortable in either one of those. The first one I fought up at 190, and then the second one at 180. They were both at my walking around weight, but everybody's dropping weight.
Not your fit weight.
Not my fight weight. And then I won my next two fights at 170.
Yeah.
So I was 2-2. And then my last fight, I was ready to fight. My fight was at 170. And then 2 days before the fight, the guy dropped out. And then my coach asked me, he said he had another fighter lined up, but he was 160. And he'd asked if I dropped another 10 pounds in 2 days.
No, you can't do that.
I still did. I did it. I had trained for 4 months for it, and I did it. I don't make any excuses, but I was drained in the end.
For sure.
Getting into that ring that day, I did not feel good. I had dropped 30 pounds overall instead of just my normal 15, 20.
I'm just amazed that you can lose weight.
And I lost that fight by armbar.
Yeah. So submission.
Right.
Yeah. And was it one of those deals where you kind of saw it coming, but were so tired you couldn't really do much about it?
A little bit. He was a good fighter, good striker. We went back and forth, but he got the better of me in the end.
Moving away from this chest-pounding bravado, we now look to the nominees who gave us the most touching moments of 2019. Celine Beth Calderon for Chasing Monsters.
Jim, her, and Mr. Ken Katsaris, those three really put me in the space like I felt like I was there. And how just every minute detail of when they walked into that house. Jim mentioned calling Margaret Bowman's parents that night and hearing Margaret's mother scream, a scream that he can't get out of his head. I haven't heard that from anybody else. And that story, and the fact that he felt comfortable to tell me that story, is just, it's another level.
Detective Mike Szczesny for Kurt Cobain blew out his brains 25 years later.
My son suffered. He seems doing a lot better now, but from PTSD, which, you know, he'd openly admit to, when he came back from serving in the 501st Airborne Division in Afghanistan, where he did like 130 combat missions. He was not the same boy that that left and came back. But he's given me a beautiful granddaughter. And he's doing a lot better now, but I know there's a lot of people out there like that.
Mm-hmm.
And our brave servicemen and women that had to serve in these crazy times, these crazy wars, my heart always goes out to them, and I really hurt when I hear one of them have passed.
Rodney Stafford for Tory, Justice Dies in Darkness.
The trial itself was very, very, very hard to sit through, because the one day did come along where they brought out the photos, evidence photos, and we saw all the images of Victoria after they had found her. Mm-hmm. So to see her skeletal remains and just some of the items she was wearing that day, like her butterfly earrings and just her Hannah Montana shirt that says "A Girl Can Dream." Yeah, we just found out more and more details. The hardest part of it was learning what Victoria had gone through for the last couple hours of her life. That's what tries on me still to this day. It's gut-wrenching, because to know that that was happening to one of my children and not even have a clue it was happening and not be able to do anything about it, all I can picture is her so scared for the last 3 hours of her life, from the time she was abducted at the school till her life was taken. It hurts to know that the fear she must have gone through.
Robert Baltovich for The Baltovich File.
Was Elizabeth Bain the love of your life?
Well, she certainly was at that time, yeah. I mean, she was the first woman I ever loved. And, you know, it was true love. Like, I've actually said to people, growing up, I didn't even believe that love existed because I'd never actually felt that way toward a woman. And then when I met Liz, I mean, it was like transcendent. But I would also say that one of the great joys of my life is I learned that I could love again. But yeah, I think she certainly was at the time. But yeah, it was tough. I mean, because I always felt that she was the love of my life. And then in the aftermath of her disappearance, you start reading things in her diary about you and you start to wonder, okay, well, how did she really feel about me?
In category 5, we look at this year's most heroic guests. Detective Cloyd Steiger of the Seattle Police Department, who solved approximately 250 homicides and entered countless dangerous and violent scenarios to defend the citizens of his beautiful home.
Yeah, any time on patrol where you thought, wow, I'm in real danger here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been, oh, yeah, absolutely. There were bullets flying all the time, you know, in that area. First of all, in the area I was working, we would have shootings almost every single night mm-hmm. in the area. But I was there when bullets were flying all the time. It was just like...
You ever had one zing by your head?
Oh, yeah. I've heard that. The zing. Yeah.
James DeBrow, a veteran reporter on organized crime, who was once famously asked, James DeBrow, how are you still alive?
A Cadillac pulled up with Pat Musitano and three of his goof buddies, you know, gangbangers. And they went over to Gordon Martineau, who was our host, when he went to get a cigarette and said, what are you doing? And he explained he was trying to get into a Domino's tunnel. It was with me and that we were doing a little research. And Pat Musitano said to Gordon Martineau, well, you shouldn't be doing anything with DeBrow. He belongs in Hamilton Bay, sleeping with the fishes, something like this.
But from what I'm seeing, it's going to be more like the other way around.
Oh, sure.
Is still going to be going strong, you know.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Hopefully. Well, going, maybe not strong. You're still going to be going, yeah. Right?
Detective Mike Sosinski, also of the Seattle PD, who worked innumerable active and cold cases and was even forced to shoot several violent offenders in public gunfights.
Our careers are stretched for so long. It seems long. I mean, regular people retire, you know, it's what, 65 or what. Mm-hmm. Now, we're like, we could have retired at 55 if we wanted. Mm-hmm. Before that, you could have retired younger. But it's a young man's job also.
Yeah.
And for some reason, people stay in homicide long. Because where else are you going to go? Either you have to get promoted out or you retire. And you're already at the top of the game. But as I said to numerous people before, you know, you take in all these homicides, all these suicides, all the blood and gore, you know, and if we were involved in shootings ourselves, and it's a whole lot of stuff, and I call it the attic, you know, your brain, and sometimes the attic gets a little bit full, and so you got to take a break, you know, take a break, calm down, and hug your loved ones.
And Robert Baltovich, who after being wrongfully convicted for murdering his girlfriend, Elizabeth Bain, did 8 years of hard time like a champ, showing more concern for the well-being of his loved ones than for himself.
And I remember just before we went into court, like we knew they had a verdict. And like I took my parents aside, right? And I just put my arms around both of them, you know? And I just said, I want you to understand something. Like, no matter what happens in that courtroom, I'm going to be okay, right? Because I was actually more worried about them than I was about myself, right? Because I'd already been kind of through a year of hell at the East Detention Center.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't really control how your family reacts, right? And so I just wanted them to know that, like, if I don't go home with you today, I'm going to be okay, right? Even if I'm not.
Up next is most grizzled moment, which is admittedly hard to define, but falls somewhere between Clint Eastwood and Nick Nolte. You'll know it when you hear it. Detective Cloyd Steiger for Confessions of a Seattle Homicide Detective.
So the chief of police at that time was a guy named Norm Stamper, who was a really nice guy. And I liked him personally, but he was a touchy-feely guy. And he thought this tragedy, this little girl getting murdered, everyone involved has to get counseling, right? And so we were ordered to go to this counseling on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock downtown. Well, at Friday night at about 7:30, the first tip came in that led me to go back to work and work all night long, and then finally making the arrest at like 6 in the morning and getting these guys in jail. Now, I was dog tired. I wanted to go home, but I'd been ordered to attend this counseling session. And I remember walking into the room, and there was this big circle of chairs, and there was this guy with a beard, and he was a psychologist or whatever. And I sat down in a chair, and he looked at me and says, "How do you feel about being involved in a case like this?" And again, I was dog-ass tired. I said, "I think if I have to come talk to a guy like you every time something like this happens, I'm in the wrong fucking line of work, and I need to think about a career change." And I got up and walked out of the room, you know. And he was like shocked, but really, if it's bothered me that much that I have to see you, then this is the wrong job for me, right?
Dr. John Faithful Hamer for TED Talks.
We are exponentially moving quickly, the technology. Yeah, man, pour yourself some more, Jamie. This is great. I'm going to nominate you for award. I think this is the most we've drank on a Murder with the Case episode before.
You come to Montreal for a podcast, this is what happens, man. Playing with the big boys here. So
yeah, or it's you. Right?
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm not going to deny that. So.
Oh, you hear that? That's porn.
You were saying. Mm.
Here we go. Okay. All gone.
All gone. Yeah.
Cheers, buddy.
Rolling with the big dogs.
Detective Mike Szczesinski for Kurt Cobain blew out his brains 25 years later.
There's not one detective in there that who knew who Kurt Cobain was. Nobody knew who Kurt was. Okay. No one knew Nirvana. These are all seasoned detectives. You know, the sergeant was, I don't know, 60 years old at the time. This was not their type of music. The music they listened to wasn't my type of music.
Right.
So why would they cover it up? Are they all getting paid to cover it up? Why? It makes no sense at all.
Marty Kerlock for Gun Schooled.
Saying, "I want a gun," in the event that it comes down to that, that things go to that absolute worst point where I have to do that. Mm-hmm. That is completely rational.
Yeah, I'm not going to be the one, like I said, the guy pissing his pants in the corner crying for mommy. I'm going to be the one fighting for my life, and it's not going to be me. There's an old phrase that I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6. Mm. I'll be the one judged by my 12 of my peers because I decided to protect myself and my family if it warranted it. And I'm sure a lot of people out there would be in the same boat.
Finally, we come down to the wire. What were the best episodes of 2019? Beginning with the VR lectures, was it Psychopathy and Psychosis, A Motive to Murder, MO and Signature, or Fetishes and Paraphilia? The reason I didn't throw in sexual sadism as a possibility is that it won Best Academy last year, and a lot of the material kind of overlapped. And now, the highest honor in true crime podcast-dom, the best dive bar of 2019. This list could have easily been thrice as long, but after much deliberation, I managed to whittle it down to Dr. Chris Kunkel for Dirty Dark Minds.
Interesting case. I mean, he was a young guy working in an investment field in New York City and had gotten into bodybuilding and gotten into taking methamphetamines and steroids and was comboing those things to continue to exercise and focus on his body and building muscle. He was also living a fast-paced financial lifestyle. And eventually the combination of the drugs and the lifestyle manifested into this manic psychosis. And he started to believe that he believed that witches were trying to kill him. And at one point the psychosis was so vivid, he saw giants walking around his neighborhood that were coming to kill him. He eventually formed the belief that his grandmother was a witch and that she possessed power in her eye and that her eye was controlling him and controlling his mother. So in order to escape this tragedy, he needed to kill her. So he knows she's coming to the house. he goes up in his bedroom and puts his bandana around his head like he's Rambo preparing for war, and he's doing push-ups waiting for her to come home. She comes home. He goes downstairs. He kills her, gouges her eye out, because that's where the power is, leaves her there, and takes his mom and I believe his sister with him. So he's, in a sense, kidnapping them, too, after he kills this woman.
But that's not what he's thinking.
No, he's thinking he's saving rescuing them. Right. He's like, rescuing them from the giants and from the witch, and it's all going to be better now.
Rodney Stafford for Tori. Justice dies in darkness.
Even though they're saying, well, we're looking in this area now and we're looking for a body, we're not looking for Victoria anymore, I still couldn't help but think, you know, maybe they're wrong. Maybe I'm still going to see her in town. I'll still see her somewhere. Maybe I will bump into her. And the search still continued for me. Even though I was being told she was gone, I didn't see any remains. I didn't see my daughter. So to me, she was still alive. For the next 2 months, that's basically all it was trying to find more and more answers and just where she was. And July 19th, when he had found Victoria's body, or Victoria's remains, it was very gut-wrenching and heartbreaking. And then to find out that basically the search we had done for the last 3 months was not needed because she was gone. Her life had been taken the night of April 8th. So just to know, like, everything that we went through for 3 months, knowing full well two people knew all the details and everything, it was really trying. It was definitely hard to accept. Like, it's one of my babies. She's gone, right? And to find out just the brutality and the heinousness of the crimes that were committed that day, it was hard to accept, but it was reality.
Detective Cloyd Steiger for Confessions of a Seattle Homicide Detective.
Did you guys get up to any more hijinks?
I mean, one time we had him in that minivan I was driving. He was in the back seat and we're downtown and he points to a guy in the street and says, "Man, that's P-Dog. He's the biggest dope dealer out on here." And I stopped the van in the middle of the street and I rolled it down the window. I go, "Hey, P-Dog, thanks for the information. It really worked out for us." and he's staring at me, drive away.
Yeah, Bernie was found dead the following morning.
Vanessa Brown for The Lowdown Murders.
Whoever was in that car, she got in and the car left and she was never seen alive again. 5 days later on October 9th, there were two duck hunters who were looking for waterfowl. So these guys pulled over and they looked over the bridge and they found Jackie.
Robert Baltovich for The Baltovich File.
You know, it was really kind of a sad day, but I remember as well looking behind me and looking at Reeser. I looked at him right in the eyes, right? And he just had this smirk on his face, just like this evil grin, like, "I got you," right? And I just remember thinking, like, do you really believe I did this? Or, like, do you just not care, right?
If you had one person in this world that was your nemesis, would it be him?
Oh, yeah. 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 That's actually one of the things that motivated me to get through this and also motivates me to this day.
You want to wipe that grin off his face.
Yeah. Again, I'm not sure if it ever will, because I'm just not sure that he actually really believed I was guilty.
Okay, you're probably wondering, what do I do? How do I do it? Can you wipe my ass for me, wee? Well, no fear. I've got two of those questions covered. Firstly, you have to be a patron of the show to vote. Then, log into patreon.com, go to the Murder Was the Case homepage, and start a voting. Each poll is listed in a separate post, so just go to all 8 individual posts, click on your preferred option, and voila! A little warning, don't dawdle when it comes to voting because the surveys will probably close by December 21st at the latest. The results will be revealed at the 2nd Annual Bloody Awards on December 26th. That's the infamously aimless Boxing Day for those of us in the Commonwealth when, let's face it, there's fuck all else to do, so I thought I'd give you a treat. Chase that Christmas cheer
with moving acceptance speeches, heartwarming musical performances, and me. And brace yourself for 2020, because I've already got a dozen episodes in the bag that'll fucking change you, man. I am serious. Next level.